Well, hey ho, everybody. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
Oh, hello. I'm Molly Wood. And surprise.
Hey ho.
Hey ho. Welcome to Make Me Smart, where we're on hiatus-ish.
Kinda.
We're going to spend the next few episodes, and they are episodes, exploring some themes from our first season while we ponder possibilities for season two. We book guests, we read all your excellent emails, and basically we just can't stay away because, and I think you know what's going to happen here.
Yeah, what?
None of us is as smart as all of us.
Nicely done. Because you know what? Even though I got a script in front of me, I wasn't looking, and I didn't know where you were going.
Nope. He did not know
where you were going. All right, let me just say
anything could happen.
I've been out for a couple of weeks, and people just messed with my studio, man. People just messed with my radio studio. I have to shuffle all my papers again. I'm just saying. All right,
the horror.
It's terrible. One thing we're not going to do, or we're going to try really hard not to do, during this hiatus-y thing that we're doing, which is not really a hiatus, it turns out. Have I ever told you about the time, by the way, that I tried to take paternity leave, and my boss here at Marketplace, many, many years ago, said, "No, I'm sorry, you can't take paternity leave." That is a true story. That is a true story. So I brought the newborn to work, and I put him under my desk, honest to God, in the car carrier, under the desk. Left him there. He was sleeping while I went into the studio. That's a true story. This kid is now 13 years old, so he's fine. But yeah, that's a true story.
So I'm assuming this is none of the bosses that are going to be mentioned in the credits later.
No. This predates them as bosses. Yeah, it's
my
a true story.
Goodness.
Yeah. So I know a thing or two about hiatuses that are not hiatuses. Let me just tell you that.
I mean, I'm just saying if it's hiatus-ish, I'm going to talk about the news. You just wait till next week, people.
There you go. Yes.
Before then, what we are going to do is take a look back at those themes like we mentioned and answer more of your questions because those just keep on coming.
Yep.
So let's get to it.
Make me smart.
Make me smart.
Hey, make me smart.
I like that last one. Hey, make me smart. You, make me smart right now.
Get on it.
You. Make me smart. Sorry, that was my drill instructor coming through. This question comes to us from Anne-Marie M. Don't know what that stands for. And there is a kind of a simple answer, a politics answer, and then a tech answer as well, which is a pretty good trifecta for one question. Here it is.
To avoid gerrymandering and bypass politics altogether, why don't state legislators just use an algorithm to determine how best to sort or create congressional districts? I think Google could do this, right?
Well, yeah, Google probably could, but let's back up here for one constitutional nanosecond here. First of all,
nice.
So we're talking here about redistricting, which is a process by which the states reapportion their congressional and electoral districts so as to comply with Supreme Court decisions talking about one man, one vote, and all of that jazz. The census is the basis for that. It is done as constitutionally required every 10 years, which means that we are now seeing in practice and also in the courts some of the fruits of redistricting that happened after the 2010 census. Yes, in theory, algorithms could do it, but politics, because you're going to have to pry the redistricting power out of state legislatures, which is how most states do it, right? States get to decide. You're going to have to pry that power out of their cold, dead, impeached hands. And you're just never, ever going to do that. And it's as anybody who follows the news knows, it's incredibly controversial. It's incredibly political. It's incredibly consequential. And it also almost always winds up in court.
And I think that I'm jumping ahead to the technology answer, but I think that although there is a constant temptation to say, can't we just do this with data and computers?
Right.
For one thing, the computers are only as good as the data. So the census itself, there are questions about how the 2020 census is going to come off and the quality of that data. And algorithms make assumptions that maybe we don't want them to make when it comes to redrawing the vote. Right now, there is a case making its way through the court system on whether Texas's redistricting and voter ID laws were discriminatory. Because, as Kai mentioned, this is an incredibly consequential topic. It is, therefore, one of those topics where it really helps to have an expert weigh in. Justin Levitt is a professor of law at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. He was also a deputy assistant attorney general in the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice. So you know what I'm saying here? Expert. So we kicked it off with a simple question. What is gerrymandering?
So gerrymandering is essentially drawing unfair districts.
And so there's an awful lot baked into that. Often people target districts that seem to look squiggly or squirrely or that don't look pleasing to the eye. But some people will say that gerrymandering is ensuring that one particular type of candidate can win or one particular type of party can win or ensuring that minorities can't elect candidates of choice when they otherwise might be able to. So a lot of people build in to gerrymandering what they mean is districts that aren't fair. There are lots of impacts to districts that are unfair, economic and otherwise, to communities. So the most tangible version is a district that's drawn that doesn't provide for representation of real people, that doesn't provide for representation of a community, means that there's not going to be a legislator who actually speaks up for that community. And that can mean development. That can mean tax breaks. That can mean getting a big employer in from out of town. That can mean getting the roads paved better or getting a new information technology to make sure that the last fiber is extended to the home. So there are a bunch of different potential solutions to ensure fair districts. One is to set laws that lock out the unfairest, so extremes of racial misconduct or partisan misconduct or extremes of breaking up city and county lines or other things like that. Even if we can't agree on what's most fair, sometimes we can agree on what's most unfair, and passing laws to keep those things out of the system let courts actually hold people's feet to the fire. It's really important for individual citizens to also step up and demand a better process. That's the only way that we get change at the state level and the states that have made change. And this all comes back to how we make sure that legislators represent real communities. And so letting people know what your community is, however you think about that, is something that every single citizen can do.
And of course, we asked him Anne-Marie's question, too.
Asking an algorithm, asking a computer to draw fair election districts is a little bit like asking an algorithm to draw a fair tax plan. Algorithms are really good at drawing objective plans, but in order to figure out what's fair, that needs people to hash out what they think is most important where in different parts of a state. And that, it turns out, is something a computer is really bad at. Aside from all the logistical questions and the fairness questions, it turns out that it's hard, and a lot harder than most people think. Some people argue technologically impossible, mathematically impossible, unless you're using a system the size of a NASA-grade supercomputer. So there are relatively few ways to draw an algorithm that account for county lines and political parties and racial background and the Voting Rights Act and all of the different rules that state law puts in that would allow for a computer like a PC to draw all kinds of different combinations. It just gets so technologically complex. And I know this is hard talking about in 2018 when everybody's got a cell phone in their pocket that does amazing, amazing things. This is still a problem that's mathematically really difficult to get to the best answer on a number of different criteria at the same time.
So as I said, the 2020 census is around the corner. It's going to be a mess, and it's really important. And that's what you need to know about the census, honestly.
Yeah, absolutely. And just voting. I mean, we've been talking about this in terms of it being a theme that we keep bringing up. We keep bringing it up in sort of a tertiary way. Like, yeah. Oh, also voting is important. So I think that because that not only is the 2020 census coming up, but so are the 2018 midterm elections, yep. And voting. Kind of a big deal.
It all gets to this thing we talked about a lot in season one, which is the nature of capitalism and whether it's working best for the best number of people. And this is all part of that.
Let us know what you think about all of this. Write us at makemesmart@marketplace.org or go to our website at makemesmart.org or tweet us at Kai Rizdahl or at Molly Wood.
This is your drum and guitar interstitial music.
Bum, 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 ba, dum, bum.
What was that? I didn't know what that was.
I was rocking out.
Oh, okay. One of the really good parts about looking back at last year is that we get to see what it was that we did at the very beginning of this podcast that kind of stuck and how it pulled through the remainder of the season and how we sort of used it and kept it in the conversation.
And connected the dots. It's also a little bit like looking back at your Instagram feed. Like, just like, oh,
wow.
Look at all my pictures. It's a little like that.
Okay.
I don't know. Am I the only one?
Yeah, I think
that?
Maybe, but okay.
Okay. Well, then back to the show. the topics that we are choosing are, of course, based on your excellent suggestions, so the things that you liked, you were most interested in. So keep those suggestions coming at makemesmart@marketplace.org. Mm-hmm. This week, we will be looking back at two episodes, our very first.
Wow.
Back when we were just babies.
God.
I know. We were so innocent then. And also our most downloaded. These two podcasts do have something in common. We, in both of them, we're trying to get at this idea of how hard it is for people to communicate across their very literally hardwired lines, philosophical lines.
So a year ago, back in January 2017, we talked to people who were at the inauguration and also at the Women's March in Los Angeles, which was the following day, if you remember that. And there were, you know, marches all over the country. And we asked them a question. What do you want people on the other side of this big disagreement question issue that we are having in this country to know about you? The first three answers you're going to hear are from the inauguration, and the next three are from the Women's March. Here you go.
For people that didn't vote for Trump, I am a patriot through and through. I grew up in the military family, and I'm as patriotic as you get, and I love everybody, no matter race, gender, ethnicity. And I just want us all to come together for our country and unify as one.
I'm really not concerned what they know about me or what they don't. they're unhappy that Trump won. I get that. I understand that. They need to just get on with their life. President Obama was president for 8 years. I didn't like it. I never missed a day of work over it. I never got in a fight over it or anything else. Went about my business. So I think they need to learn to do the same thing.
Well, about me, I guess, I don't know, I'm just a regular guy, just like everyone else that's here. But about other Trump supporters, I mean, we're all nice people. Most of us are. I mean, there are some bad people out there, but most people are good at heart, I think. And just give everyone a chance. That's all.
That we're all human, that we're not on different teams. That if they took the time to try to talk to us, that we'd be willing to talk and engage and learn from one another. We're not hostile. We don't think they're all deplorable. We're willing to bridge that gap if they are.
That I'm an American, just like them, that I have every right. I deserve respect. I deserve respect as a woman, as a minority, and as a citizen of this country.
I love America. And I, you know, for those who voted for him that are hurting economically, I feel your pain. We all want a better America. We need to do it together, not be divided.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's intense.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. See, like looking back at your Instagram photos is fun. No, doesn't it feel like?
Oh, snap. Yeah. All right. So those were a couple of people, six technically, who wanted the other side to know that they were willing to listen, I guess, is sort of the gist of that. We're going to hear now from George Lakoff in a second, who's going to tell us about that listening thing, especially how listening to ideas that contradict sort of our held beliefs is a lot harder than it sounds. First, though, as always, got to pay the bills.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more, Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews, and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you.
As it turns out, asking that question, that sort of what is something that you want people on the other side to know about you, that started us down a primrose path that led to Professor George Lakoff, primrose. Professor Emeritus of Cognitive Science. I don't know where that came from. Things just happen in the brain.
Go with it.
He would probably, you know what? You know
totally
who would know?
Would.
Lakoff.
He totally would, yeah.
He would know. He is a professor of cognitive science and linguistics, and he explained that essentially what sides really means is a shared group of beliefs, and those beliefs are biological. They are neurologically hardwired into our brains.
20 years ago, more than 20 years ago, actually, George Lakoff wrote a book called Moral Politics, which kind of explored the reasons, the cognitive reasons why it is so difficult to actually hear, you know, not just listen to, but hear and absorb somebody else's worldview.
And here is, on that note, our full interview with George Lakoff, because he's way better at explaining this than we are, from way back in the past, April 2017.
I study the mind, the brain, and language. Most thought is unconscious, about 98%. I study mostly unconscious thought and its contribution to conscious thought.
And its contribution to politics and society, too, which seems extremely relevant as it happens right now.
That's right. I've been doing that since 1996.
So, and this time around, you predicted, although we should say you are no fan of Donald Trump, you predicted that he would win based on what he was saying, basically.
Based on what he was saying, how he was saying it, and how he very cleverly managed to manipulate other people's brains to his advantage as a super salesman, which he's been doing for 50 years. He instinctively knows exactly how to do that. He knows what to say. And those tweets that he gives are entirely strategic. There are four types. Each of them fits a strategy. And he has an advantage when other people think that he's just crazy or stupid.
So let's play some tape, actually. We have tape of the president. This is not long after the election, I think.
When I was young, we were always winning things in this country. We'd win with trade. We'd win with wars.
He said it so much, I can almost repeat the next line. There's going to be so much winning, you're going to be sick and tired of winning.
Yep.
And he knew what he was doing.
Boy, did he know what he was doing. Mm. First of all, there are in the country about 35% of Americans who have what I'll call strict father morality. That is, they believe that father knows best, that the father is the authority, that what he says is right, that if children don't obey him, they have to be given tough love and punished until they do, and that this gives rise to a view that you have to be disciplined. The main thing is that this is a natural thing, that this is how the world should be, how it is. And if you look at history, you will see that the strict fathers win. So that if you want to see who's better than who, you look at who beat who. And so you have religion won out. You have God above man. You have we have conquered nature. You have man above nature. We can take anything we want for our use. You have the strong above the weak. We need, you know, a strong army and so on. That hierarchy follows from one idea. It's not a bunch of different ideas. It's strict father morality as applied to all aspects of life. Hmm. That is what Trump not only believes, he acts and he assumes is correct. And he knows that there are about 35% of the country, the 35% who still support him, who also believe this, even if they're poor.
Right.
The main thing is that if that is your worldview and that's your morality, that defines who you are as a person. It's self-definition. And people don't vote against their self-definition. Not only that, it doesn't matter if Trump lies to them and they know he's lying. Because there's a higher truth, which is strict father morality itself, which has consequences, and that they are truer than any lies, and that if you deny that, if you accept the lies as more important, you're denying your self-identity. That's why there are alternative facts.
Okay. Well, yeah, but here's oh, my goodness, so many questions.
I know. I have 10 to 100 questions as follow-ups.
I know. So here comes just one. If whoever's running against Donald Trump in 2020 calls you up and says, Professor Lakoff, George, what do I do against this guy who has this insight into the American political mindset? What do I do?
What you do is the following. First, you have to understand your own moral views. There is what are called nurturant morality. That is, you care about other people. In a family, adults care about their children, are honest with them. They try to talk directly with them and have and answer their all their questions. They take care of them. They want them to be fulfilled in life, and they want them to care about other people. And that comes out as a progressive moral view, which goes like this, that citizens care about other citizens, work through the government to provide resources, public resources for everybody, starting with business. You can't have a business if you don't have streets and roads and airports and sewers and, science like computer science developed by the NSF. And that isn't the government. It's the people. It's the public. The private depends on the public. If you have strict father morality, then you did it all. It's personal responsibility.
In moral politics, you sort of laid out this idea of the strict father morality and the nurturing parent, and have argued that conservatives have been winning on that. This is sort of loaded, but is it successful because we are fundamentally a patriarchy? Is it something about our society that lets us embrace that more? Or is it sort of a human, like, do you think that that is a human difference?
First of all, the difference is always going to be there. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be there because of what children naturally experience from birth. That is, they're better off if they're nurtured on the one hand, and they're better off if they listen to their parents on the other. Hmm. And the first gives rise to nurturant parent morality, a nurturant parent way of raising children. The second to a strict father way of raising children. They're always going to be there. And the conservatives figured out a long time ago that they could use language to activate their ideas. Every word activates what is called a frame, which activates, in politics, a moral system in your brain. And one of the major things you have to know is that people are not just all one or the other. Most conservatives have some progressive views about some things or other. Most progressives have some conservative things about some things or other, perhaps business or whatever. And in the brain, that means you have both moral systems mainly used for one thing but not the other. But they are what are called mutually inhibitive. That is, the activation of one turns off the other. Mm-hmm. Well, the conservatives figured out how to do this a long time ago. They set up the Leadership Institute back in 1994. To train leaders to think and talk conservative, and then to get talking points every day, and to be booked on radio and TV, and so on. They have trained 160,000 of them by 2014 all over the country. They've been out there using those skills for many, many years.
All right, back in just a sec with more from George Lakoff. So part one was a lot about the conservative worldview. The first question I had as we sort of changed subjects was, how are the Democrats different? Here's what he said.
What the Democrats largely had a problem, which is they went to college.
Oh, man.
I'm serious.
I get it.
If you're a conservative and you go to college, what are you going to study? Most likely you're going to take some business courses, which means you're going to be taking a marketing course. And marketing professors study my field, cognitive science. They study that people think in terms of frames, metaphors, narratives, emotions, images, and so on. And so it's natural to be able to market your ideas if you're a conservative. But you don't take those courses if you're a progressive and you're interested in politics. You know, you don't take cognitive science or neuroscience or marketing. What you do is you take political science, law, public policy, economic theory, not business, and you learn a different way of thinking. Once you get a worldview, which is a lot of ideas that are in very complex circuits in your brain, and they become fixed. You use that worldview every day so that it's just natural. It's there. It's automatic. It's instantaneous. It's just present all the time. That becomes what I'll call a neural filter. Yeah. So if you can only understand what your brain allows you to understand. So a fact comes in. What happens if it doesn't fit your brain? One, you might notice it. Two, you could ignore it. Three, it can be changed in less than a tenth of a second. That's another thing we can get into.
Wait, let me make sure I understood. Your facts can be changed in less than a tenth of a second? What?
So you're saying that information, much like time, is relative based on your worldview?
Based on your worldview. And
What does that mean for our fake news problem?
Yeah.
You got a big problem.
Yeah.
That's why the fake news is there. That's why it works.
One of the things that you point out in some of your research is that we will not just change information, but reject it. We may hear, because one thing we often counsel people in trying to fight fake news or fight propaganda or misinformation is to have an awareness, expose themselves to the other side. But your research seems to argue that that is totally ineffective, that by exposing them to the other side, they'll just reject it.
Not necessarily.
Okay, I mean, good. Hope.
Well, there is hope, and it's a very and that's very important to know. But it takes effort. That is, okay, I listen to Trump, I listen to all those guys, and I have to effortfully just say, hey, this ain't true, go on and on, And I know that. I know what's coming. I have to set up in advance. I know what to expect from them, so I can use my expectations of what's not going to be true to do that. Mm. And therefore, it's very important to understand how they are thinking. What they're about. You have to understand the other person. And it's a form of empathy. Empathy is not necessarily being sympathetic to someone else, but it has to do with really putting yourself in their shoes so you know what they're doing and what they could be doing to you.
Yeah.
What then, and you're critical, actually, of how the media is covering Mr. Trump and the words we are using. So what are we to do when our job is, in theory, to inform rather than persuade?
Excellent. What you do is, first of all, understand he's probably trying to get away from anything important you're saying that's true. So say your important truths first. Always preempt with the truth. Frame first with the truth and with what is important. Next, if he has a diversion about something unimportant, he's attacking Meryl Streep or something, you again point out that there's a diversion and you talk about whatever is true there about it. Then if he has a tweet, and his tweets are all strategic to divert your attention from other things or to do preemptive.
That's what I've been saying. Sorry, that's what I've been saying.
You've
on
hit
Twitter
on Kai's obsession.
A year and a half.
By the way, you are absolutely right. I have a little diagram for you. Molly has it, that goes through the four types of tweets. And it shows you exactly what you've been saying. You're absolutely right. There are four types. One is there's a preemptive framing. Second, there is diversion. You talk about Meryl Streep instead of what's important, instead of the Russians. Then there is attack the messenger. You attack the press or whoever. And last, there are trial balloons. You say, everybody should have nuclear weapons or whatever, and you see if that's taken seriously or some combination of those. Those are the four types of tweets, and they're all strategic. They're all used strategically. He is not just staying up at night having nightmares and having weird emotions and so on. He's strategic. Mm.
Can I ask you the literally versus seriously question that came up so much during the campaign, right? Should we take Donald Trump literally or should we take him seriously? And depending on what side of his arguments you were on, you were doing it the wrong way. Should we not have taken him both ways?
Well, yes. The point is that the term literal misses the fact that we normally think metaphorically and in terms of frames. Mm. And so most language is like that. And it's called literal language because they miss the fact that it's unconscious. So the whole definition of what counts as literal misses the nature of unconscious thought. What's going on is that there is a strict father notion which comes from family ideas, and that is a metaphor, and it's there in your brain. Deep conceptual metaphors are physical. They are neural circuits that link two ideas in your brain, and they're active, and those ideas have influence, and they have entailments. And you have to understand that that is what's really going on there unconsciously. Most of the Democrats I know a lot of wonderful people in the Democratic Party, and they have the following properties. They're very smart. They're very well-intentioned. They have very good values. They work hard. They're honest. And they get it wrong. mm-hmm. and they get it wrong mm-hmm. because they went to college and they did so well, mm-hmm. and they've been using it all their life. And it's hard to change, when that happens.
Well, that is a remarkable segue to what we like to call our Make Me Smart question, which is the last question that we have to ask every guest, which is, what is something that you thought you knew that you later turned out to be wrong about?
I thought Hillary would win.
All right. Now, you all liked hearing from George Lakoff so much that this, again, we should mention, was our most, I think, mm-hmm. downloaded episode, because he indeed made a whole bunch of us smart. But you liked him so much that on our holiday episode, we got him back on the phone for some tips on how to communicate with your relatives when you do not share political values, which was like news you can use. Go check that out if, I don't know, spring break is upcoming and you're worried. That's episode 41 at makemesmart.org. And that is it for us this week. Keep sending us your thoughts and suggestions about our first year and what you want us to do differently and what else you'd like to hear more of. That is all at makemesmart@marketplace.org, our email address. And we read them. We do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, bye.
I'm waiting. Yeah. Hold on. All right, here we go. Make Me Smart is produced by Jenny Josephson and senior producer Nancy Fargali. This week's program was engineered by... No, it was engineered by Drew Jostad. Our theme music is composed by Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez.
The executive director of On Demand is Satara Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark, neither of whom
yes.
made Kai put a baby under his desk on paternity leave.
That is correct. He slept. It was all good. Came in 3 days a week.
No, they don't care.
Came in 3 days a week.
They don't care where they are.
Yep. 3 days a week with
That's
a baby.
Cool, man. That would never happen in Denmark.
No. And I was going to explain why we're talking about Denmark, but that's, yeah, we haven't got time.
But you know what? It's better as a non sequitur.
Maybe in the next non-hiatus episode.
Hey, maybe.
Maybe, because we're doing it again.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.